Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Of course, on Thursdays, it's not really one man's view. It's actually multiple people's view because we have guys and gals. I'm the expert counsel, and it is time for an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. Today, we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff. We're going to answer questions and respond to topics about how America First is becoming America Last. Ron Paul and Chris Rossini will talk about that. We'll talk about dealing with shoulder sprains. That's something I unfortunately know a lot more about than I want to. And how to prevent future injuries and re-injuries after one. Well, old dog bones. And then Chef Ken Daniels is going to talk about lesser known cuts of meat. He's going to start off with an easy one somebody asked him about, chuck eye. I'm going to tell you something about chuck eye you may not know. I've said it before, but I find a lot of things I've said before. That doesn't mean everybody heard it the first time or second or even third, so we'll make it at least four. Nick Holsoss will talk about making and maintaining a cheese mother with skim milk. Jesse Markowitz will talk about what open source software is and why you might want it. Well, open source software is how you get this show every day. Well, I guess if you're a YouTube listener, not so much, but if you listen to my show on any podcast platform, Apple, Spotify, Pocket Cast, Fountain FM, Breeze, whatever, right? If you listen to my podcast in any of those, the way that my show gets to you is through something called RSS, which is included in software called WordPress that my website runs on. My website runs on open source software. Joel Riles will talk about one of the biggest mistakes in training your dog: rushing, going too fast, exceeding the dog's capacity to learn. And then I'm going to talk about gerrymandering in a way that I bet you've never heard before. I mean, I guarantee you've never heard this. I guarantee nobody's ever said this. But I actually believe that it's true, and I think even the people doing it, they don't realize what they're doing, that they're doing it for this reason. What if I told you gerrymandering is actually a states' rights issue? And that it actually became a states' rights issue, and versus just a way to manipulate elections in a very famous year. And it ain't, you know, 2020 or any time that anybody pretty much alive today was alive. I don't think anybody was alive. I don't think the oldest person in the world today was not alive when this happened. It was the year synonymous with so many changes in our society, 1913. That's when gerrymandering, you could literally defend it, is a states' rights issue. It's been well over 100 years, and yet I don't know that I've ever heard anybody defend it as such. I think when I explain it, even if you hate it, or if you like it, or you don't like it, or you're indifferent to it, I think you'll tend to agree that at least the case that I'm making is a reasonable case to make. Even if you don't believe it's valid, it's a reasonable case. If I get that far, that means I've opened your mind to looking at things from a different angle, and that's the real reason I'm doing it. It's not about convincing anybody of anything, or convincing you that I'm right about this. It's about helping you train your mind to look at issues that look like cut and dry A and B, one and zero, binary issues, and say, wait a minute, are there more layers to this? How can I critically pull this apart and examine it and ask, why is this happening? Why is it happening the way that it is? Why has it been happening for so long? Why have all the efforts to make it go away one way or another failed? And is there more to the story? That's what we're going to talk about today. Before we do, I want to remind you again about my book, Laws of Life, Ditch the System, Design Your Life. We're still selling anywhere between 4 to 10 copies a day. That's long after the big splash we made with launch and we made all the bestsellers lists and everything. But man, that is sustained sales. And that's more than I expected, honestly. But if you haven't picked up a copy yet, please do so. If you're thinking about somebody in your life that could use a Jack-style kick in the butt but might not sit down and listen to a podcast, get them a copy. Send it to them. I mean, a lot of times, even when people don't read a book right away, it kind of sticks around. It's there. One day, they're like, I wonder, and they pick it up and they read it. And I think that this would be an incredible gift for you to give to that young person in your life. Especially, let me tell you something about the time we're in right now. We're heading to back to school. And that means a lot of youngsters are heading off to college. This would be a great book for them to read before they go. Now, it might actually sour them a little bit on it or make them think about the path they're choosing at college a little differently. Maybe it would result in a new major, you know. Another thing I'll tell you is if you've got somebody in your life who's fixing to go in the military, Thad, who is a very good friend of the TSP community, if you've been to workshops, you definitely met this guy. He's been an Army combatives instructor. He's in the ADA, which is Air Defense Artillery, so combat arms. He's currently a first sergeant, one of the youngest first sergeants in the military. Amazing guy. He read my book, and he texted me the following. When I was a drill sergeant, I would have hoped that every soldier I was sent had read this book before they joined the Army. So that might be another group of people in your life you want to give a copy of this book to. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and hear from our first question today. This is from Ron Paul and Chris Rossini. They're asking and answering their own question here. Why did Trump and company abandon America First so quickly?
Well, we're going to talk today, Chris, a little bit about a policy position that is very annoying to a lot of us. And Axios reported it early on, that was a couple of days ago. States that boycott Israeli companies will lose disaster relief funds, DHS says. Which is crazy because they never should have had the federal funds. And even if you say, well, they have the funds, what is this? It's a regulation of speech. And that, to me, Chris, is the real problem here.
Yeah, Dr. Paul, it's, you know, we're only 7 months into President Trump's second term. And this has been a lot for Americans to take in these 7 months with whatever it is that you want to call it that Trump has with Israel. It's a lot to accept. We had the act of war with Iran. You know, this was the peace ticket, and all of a sudden he's throwing bombs on Iran. Even bigger, you know, outcries is our tax money being used for the horrendous treatment of Gaza. Then you have representatives saying, you know, we're voting on like 20 bills of anti-Semitism stuff. You know, we're here. We have to start focusing on America. We have representatives complaining about that. Restriction of speech for foreigners that come here. Now this anti-boycott. We have the First Amendment in this country. You could say we have freedom of speech and the freedom to boycott whoever we want. Any other country, we could boycott our own country. Companies here are, you know, we have that freedom. That's what it means to be an American. And the federal government is going to withhold our tax money for our natural disasters if the state boycotts a foreign country? I mean, what are they thinking? In fact, we're not the only ones thinking this. The backlash was so massive and incredible that they started backpedaling. They rephrased what they did. I don't know if they took it away, but they rephrased it. This whole thing, this is too much. We're only 7 months in, and Americans are getting fed up with all of this.
You know, there's a consensus among many, many people in the media and various organizations. They come down on the side that even if you whisper or say something that is not directed at Israel immediately or directly, that you're an anti-Semite, you know, and then they want to take you to task over that. But, you know, when I took a vote, I voted against every penny that they wanted to send to Israel. Oh, that made me an anti-Semite. Yeah, but I voted against every penny going to anybody. Yeah, you know, and none of them should have had money.
You know, Dr. Paul and I, before the show, we were talking about how sad that we even have to have this show about this. You know, with President Trump, of all people, you know, everybody was so sure that we were getting America First this time. All the dancing, all the shows, you know, to get the votes. And, you know, at first, it was looking good. It was looking really good. In fact, people were accusing us of being Trump supporters because we were reporting all the good stuff that was going on at the beginning. But then, boy, what a massive change. And it's, you know, we have to report it as it is. Not America first. This, all of this Israel stuff is not America first. But it doesn't even stop there. The most basic one that everybody wanted was Ukraine. And he's going to end it on day one. We are now 7 months, and he is arming Ukraine, turning it into his war. What was so easy to pass off as Biden's war, he is making his own. This is all going in the wrong direction. And, you know, it's sad. This is not what we wanted. This is not what so many millions of Americans wanted, but it's what it is. We need to go in the opposite direction. America first. Bring the troops home. And all foreign aid to all of these nations. We can't afford it. Our government can't pay its bills. We can't pay our bills. We're, the country is a reflection of the government. Everybody's in debt. The government is in debt as if it doesn't exist. They're just going forward, same thing. Wrong. Hopefully things change, but as of now, wrong.
There's definitely a problem here, but I also think that we're getting a little quick to jump the gun on some of this stuff. So, did Trump actually ban aid to states in emergency situations or cities that boycott Israel or Israeli companies? No, he didn't. But I saw the thing, and it said, you saw a draft. The actually enacted order did not include that. Now, I'm not defending Trump here, but I'm at least open to the idea that he didn't put that in there. And I'll tell you why. Because Trump loves to give away money. Trump knows that when he gives money to a city, a state, whatever, that it buys him more support. It gins up his ability. He can go out and brag. He loves to brag about numbers in every direction. Like, I just don't see him doing that. Now, I do think somebody in his orbit did it. And I think when it got called out, Trump probably flipped his orange lid and said, no, we're not doing this. Again, not because he is so America first, because that's a dumb thing for a president to do. That can't work out well for you. That is a bad idea, and it is stupid politics. And Trump does some stupid shit, but in the end, what he does always seems to work for him. And that's something that would never work. I do think we have gotten completely polarized on this issue, and that there are very few adults left in the room. At least Ron and Chris are among the adults left in the room. And this is what I mean by this. I just listened to some commentator. It was actually, I think, a House member, Republican, on Fox News this morning when I went out to talk to my wife for a minute. The TV was on. Say the following. This concept of separating anti-Zionism from anti-Semitism is ridiculous. No! No! That is ridiculous. That's asinine. Israel is a sovereign nation. To criticize the actions of Israel is not anti-Semitic. And here's how I can prove it to you. Pick a country you don't like. Let's say Russia. Okay? Or if you're a Democrat, let's say America, right? Okay, so is criticizing the policy of Russia or America anti-Christian? I mean, The predominant majority religion of both countries is Christian. So is it anti-Christian to criticize Russia when like 90% of the population is Eastern Orthodox Christian? Is it? Or are you criticizing the country? This is the same shit. And both sides do it, and they do it wherever it works out for them. Criticize a black politician on the left and you are a racist. Criticize a black politician on the right and you're doing God's work. You see how that works? It's all nonsense. And save these thoughts for when I get to my section at the end about gerrymandering, so you remember I am always even-handed, and I am not going to say what I'm going to say when I get to that because it benefits me in any way, because it really doesn't. Anyway, let's move on and talk about something a little bit more, practical. Of application in our daily lives, and that is shoulder injuries. And we're going to talk to Doc Bones about that.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. Today we hear from Sam, who writes, my name is Sam, For context, I'm a mechanic from Wisconsin, and several months ago I got a pretty severe muscle strain in my left shoulder at work. I took it easy for a few weeks and let it heal up before really using it again. Recently I was trying to pull an axle out of a car. I see you're the kind of guy that likes a challenge, Sam. And felt a familiar sharp pain in my shoulder. Wasn't nearly as bad this time, but now I worry about damaging my shoulders more. 25 years old, I need to keep working. Many thanks in advance. Sam, to understand shoulder injuries, I guess we should start by discussing the anatomy. The shoulder joint, or in medicalese, the glenohumeral joint, is a ball and socket joint that connects the upper arm, also called the humerus, to the shoulder blade, also called the scapula. The shoulder's design prioritizes mobility over stability, making it versatile but susceptible to injury. The shoulder joint is made up of bones. The ball-shaped head of the humerus fits into the socket of the scapula. The socket is shallow, which enhances mobility, again, but reduces stability. Cartilage, a ring of cartilage called the labrum, cushions the joint. Key ligaments stabilize the joint and prevent upward dislocation. Muscles, a group called the rotator cuff, stabilize the joint, and others like the deltoids, pecs, and lats are there for power movements. And there's also the bursa, a fluid-filled sac which reduces friction between the rotator cuff and parts of the shoulder blade. Finally, there's a series of nerves and blood vessels that pass through there for movement, sensation, and circulation. All of these parts together allow the shoulder joint the extensive range of motion needed for arm movements like throwing or lifting. Unfortunately, the joint relies heavily on muscles and ligaments rather than bone structure, and that's why it's unstable. Shoulder injuries are common, especially among athletes or those who frequently use their arms overhead, like you might when you have a car on a hydraulic lift. They range from minor sprains and strains to more serious conditions like rotator cuff tears or dislocations. Understanding the different types of injuries and their causes is crucial for proper diagnosis and treatment. Sprains, well, this is damage to ligaments, which connect bones. These can be stretched or torn, causing pain and instability. Very common. Strains, also very common. Muscles or tendons can be overstretched or torn, leading to pain and limited movement. This is, Sam, what you say you had in the past. Then there's rotator cuff tears. Tears in the tendons of the rotator cuff muscles can cause pain, weakness, and difficulty with arm movement. That's a major injury you see in baseball pitchers. Shoulder dislocation, where the upper arm bone can pop out of the shoulder socket, causing significant pain and instability. Shoulder impingement, which is inflammation of the tendons and bursa in the shoulder joint, that leads to pain and limited range of motion. And, of course, in extreme cases, bone fractures. Now, what causes this shoulder damage? Trauma, like falls, direct blows, or sudden impact, can cause a range of injuries, including the dislocations and fractures and sprains that I just talked about. Activities involving repetitive overhead movements, such as swimming, baseball, or certain jobs, like yours, can lead to rotator cuff tears, impingement, or tendonitis. Age-related degeneration. As people age, tendons weaken and become more susceptible to tears, especially the rotator cuff. Poor posture and biomechanics, improper form during exercise or daily activities, can contribute to shoulder injuries. Now, what can you expect to see in a shoulder injury? Pain, of course. Pain can be sharp, dull, aching, or radiating, and can worsen with certain movements. A limited range of motion. You might have difficulty lifting the arm, reaching behind the back, or rotating the shoulder. Weakness. Inability to lift or control the arm, especially with rotator cuff tears. Swelling and bruising. Clicking, popping, or grinding sensations. Even visible deformity, like you see with dislocations or certain fractures. So, Sam, short of doing surgery to repair and stabilize the joint, which sometimes involves a lengthy recovery, steroid shots and anti-inflammatory medicines are very common treatments. The important thing is to give an injured shoulder rest. You may have to work, and this is a dilemma, as your injury can worsen with repeated strenuous movements. Since this is not the first time you've dealt with this, it's important for you to have a plan of action that includes warm-up, stretching exercises, and strengthening the muscles to serve the shoulder joint better. So you need to deal with that. I tell you, I personally have done warm-up stretching and strength building on a regular basis to support what I had 25 years ago. That was a torn labrum, part of the shoulder joint as well. And now I'm pretty much 100%, even at a very advanced age. So Sam, if your pain is severe, of course, you're experiencing numbness or tingling, redness, heat, or fever, you should get it checked out by an ortho guy, and I mean soon. At the very least, you'll probably get x-rays or MRIs to check for things like arthritis and trauma damage. Acute injuries are treated with ice packs for the first 24 to 48 hours. You'll also be treated with anti-inflammatory injections or meds for pain, and some use arnica oil, although you have to apply that a lot to help decrease discomfort. Further along, a plan of action with physical therapy to support and strengthen any weak areas is going to be important. Sam, I hope this helps. And by the way, take it easy, will ya? This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about over 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
Good stuff from Bones. I would add Dr. Christopher's Complete Tissue and Bone for any type of injury like this. Everything else he said, stick to that, especially the resting and what have you. But I've had several injuries deeply aided by Dr. Christopher's. It's available on Amazon, and you can pick it up through T-Spaz. And if you were to go to my site and thesurvivalpodcast.com and just search for Dr. DR period space Christopher's, or even Comfrey, you will probably find it. It has more than just Comfrey in it. It does help with pain to a degree almost immediately, but it's less about pain reduction and it's more about deep tissue healing. And a lot of that has to do with the Comfrey and some of the other stuff in it. And everybody that I know who's given it a try for especially chronic things like this, if they have been consistent with applying it at least initially three times a day, and then after a couple weeks of that, maybe twice a day, has had amazing results with it eventually. Next up, let's talk about underrated cuts of meat. We're leading off a series here from Chef Ken Daniels, this one on chuck eye.
Today's question comes from Mac, who asks, I'd like to learn about what the chuck eye is. I've only known chuck for roast. Is this something I can find on the grocery shelf, or do I need to ask for it? Mac, you couldn't have picked a better way to kick off this new series, because this is exactly what we're here to do. Uncover these lesser-known cuts, the pieces of the animal that often go unnoticed but can bring tremendous value and flavor when you know what you're working with. And this one feels especially close for me right now, because beyond being a chef who's worked with beef for years, I'm actively butchering these days at Crunchy Mama Farms. And let me tell you, when you're standing there breaking down an entire side of beef, your whole perspective changes. You stop thinking in terms of grocery store labels, and you start to understand that every cut has a place, a purpose, and a personality. And that's why the chuck eye is such a perfect first topic for this series. So what exactly is the chuck eye? Let's talk anatomy for a minute. The chuck section is the front shoulder of the cow, a hard-working area that's known for being tough. This is why most of us associate chuck with big roasts or stew meat, long braises that tenderize it over hours of slow cooking. But if you look at where the chuck meets the rib primal, that rib section that gives us rib eyes and prime rib, there's a little overlap. Right at that intersection, tucked into the first couple of inches of the chuck, is a small group of steaks that are essentially a continuation of the ribeye muscle itself. This is where the chuck eye lives. It's actually the same muscle that gives the ribeye its marbling and tenderness. But as you move forward into the shoulder, that muscle gets surrounded by more tough muscles. So the chuck eye really exists in this fascinating transition zone. Part ribeye, part chuck. And that's why it's so lesser known. It's not a large section. And in fact, there are only about two chuck eye steaks on either side of the cow that truly match that ribeye quality, which means they're rare by nature, not something you'll see piled up in the meat case like ribeyes or strip steaks. Most people think of the chuck as one big piece destined for slow cooking. So the chuck eye gets lost in that larger narrative, unless you're a butcher or a chef who knows exactly where to look. And that brings us to a beautiful truth about the chuck eye. It's essentially hidden in plain sight, a cut that most folks walk right past without realizing they're missing a chance at something really special. Now let's talk about why this cut is so delicious, because that's really the heart of this. The chuck eye is often called the poor man's ribeye, and that phrase isn't just a clever nickname, it's grounded in reality, because this cut is literally an extension of the ribeye muscle. It brings with it a lot of the same qualities we prize in a ribeye steak: rich marbling, deep beefy flavor, tenderness, but often at a much lower price point. The difference is that as you move forward into the chuck, the muscle fibers tighten up just a bit, the surrounding muscles start to intrude a little, and you're dealing with a steak that demands just a little more respect when you cook it. Handled right, though, the chuck eye delivers that same kind of satisfaction, that juicy, tender bite, that rich, mouth-coating flavor, and it feels like a secret weapon because so few people realize what it is. So, how do you cook it? You can treat a good chuck eye almost exactly the same way. It's a cut that does beautifully with a hot and fast cooking method, searing in a ripping hot cast iron pan or over a hot grill. Because it comes from a hard-working part of the animal, it's important to respect the thickness, ideally about an inch to an inch and a quarter, and keep an eye on the internal temperature so you don't overdo it. Medium rare to medium is where this cut shines. About 130 to 135 degrees internal temperature. Go past that, and you'll start to notice it firming up a little more than a ribeye would. That's just its nature. If you really want to dial it in, a reverse sear method works wonders. Bring it up slowly in a low oven or on the cooler side of the grill until it's approaching 110 degrees internal. Then hit it fast and hot for that caramelized crust. This gives you a tender, juicy steak with perfect edge-to-edge doneness. And here's something else to love about the chuck eye. It's packed with flavor. Grass-fed chuck eye in particular carries that deep, mineral, almost earthy beefiness that really sings when paired simply. Coarse salt, maybe a crack of pepper, a knob of butter if you're feeling indulgent. You don't need to complicate it. This is a cut that rewards simplicity. So where the hell can you find a chuck eye? This is where it gets interesting, because it's not a cut you're likely to stumble upon in the average grocery store meat case. There just aren't enough chuck eye steaks on a single animal to stock them regularly, and most grocery store meat programs break down the chuck into roast, stew meat, or grind without bothering to pull out those two special steaks from each side. But here's the good news. A good butcher knows exactly what a chuck eye is, and they can help you get your hands on one if you ask. Sometimes they'll have them tucked away. Sometimes they can pull them fresh from a chuck roll they're breaking down. And sometimes if they know you're a customer who values those lesser known cuts, they'll start setting them aside for you. This is one of the reasons why building a relationship with a butcher matters. When you walk in and ask for something like a chuck eye, you're signaling that you appreciate the craft of butchery, that you value cuts beyond the obvious, that you understand there's a whole world of flavor hidden in parts of the animal most folks overlook. So, Mac, your question isn't just a great entry point for today's discussion. It's the perfect opening for this entire series about lesser-known cuts of beef. The goal is to shine a light on cuts that deserve more attention, demystifying where they come from, explaining why they're special, and showing you how to cook them with confidence. Next time you're at a butcher shop, they'll ask about the chuck eye. For more recipes and info, check me out at bloodsugarchef.com and drinkeatlearn.com. Keep those questions coming in, and until next time, this is Ken, the Blood Sugar Chef. Cheers.
So the only problem with the chuck eye is too many people know about the chuck eye. The chuck eye is also known as a Delmonico steak. In fact, the very famous restaurant in New York, Delmonico's, was built on that. Now, the ironic thing is if you go to Delmonico's today and order a Delmonico, you actually get a ribeye. And it is exactly for the reason that Ken gave you. You can only get 2 to 3 chuck eyes per chuck, so that's 4 to 6 per cow, and you get a lot more ribeyes. And 2 to 3 depends on how thick you like them. The thickness I cut them, I generally get 2. And he's right, as you go further up that muscle group toward the head, it is not really a chuck eye anymore. And I'll also tell you that sometimes when you get a whole chuck roll, the chuck eye portion isn't that great. It all depends on the cow, its age, its maturity level, its marbling level, how big it was, a bunch of other things. The interesting thing, though, is you don't have to buy a chuck roll to get one of these. You can get them at the store, though. They don't cost much less than ribeyes anymore. And sadly, chuck doesn't either. But every once in a while, chuck is one of those cuts that really does go on sale. And they usually take about 2 to 3 inch thick slabs of chuck, and they take the whole chuck, and all they do is just lay it down, give maybe a little bit of a trim up, and take a little bit of the excess off here and there, and then they just ka-chunk, 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 and they usually get about, you know, 5 of those, maybe 6 of those, depending on how big, again, how big it is, per chuck roast. And then when you buy a chuck roast, what you're really buying is one of those slabs. Well, the first one that comes off is basically 2 cuts, and they're both wonderful. It's the chuck eye and what we call a Denver steak. And so all you have to do is when you see those big slabs of chuck roast on sale, Just look at them. And when you see the one that's got a little kind of, you know, ribeye shaped one side to it with nice marbling, it looks like a little ribeye, that's the chuckeye. And it'll be really obvious if you got that end piece, because it'll be a nice, well-defined piece of meat. The strip on the other side, that's your Denver steak. And all you don't even need a knife to do this, though it's helpful. Usually you can just grab them and pull them apart and then cut them to appropriate thickness and size for what you want to do with them. Now here's the other secret about the chuck roll. Almost every piece of it can be cooked like a steak and is pretty damn good. In a lot of ways, it's like getting a whole sirloin. All of it's steak, all of it's good. I actually think chuck is better than sirloin, especially certain cuts of it cooked as a steak, even though it's not done as much, because it has got more fat and more marbling. But like a sirloin, there's certainly a difference between like your picanha and your, you know, your baseball steaks and your top sirloin and things like that. The quality is not quite as good, but it's all good. And the more you learn about that chuck roll, the more you'll realize it is one of the best values out there. And one of the best places to get a hold of one at a great price is a Costco Business Center, if you happen to have one near you. We do have one, but it is like, it's in hell. It's in downtown Dallas. It is a haul for us, and it is not just a long drive. It is a miserable drive with lots of people in the way. It's still worth doing once in a while, and we do it. All right, moving on. Let's talk about making a cheese mother using non-fat milk and maintaining your cheese mother. What's a cheese mother? Yeah, Nicole will tell you.
Well, howdy, TSP. This is Nicole Sauce from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast, and I've got a question from Colonel Roy about maintaining your mother cheese culture, which we talked about back in episode 3706, when I told you how to take your culture and then keep it alive for cheese making. His question is this: in making the culture, is it important or better to have more milk versus cream, or more cream in the culture, or is it okay to have all skimmed milk with no cream? Details: I presume the bacteria preserves the sugars of the milk to feed it and do this thing, so I think it does not need any cream. Which is the fat of the batch? If I'm going to use a portion of raw milk and the fat is not necessary, then I'd rather save my cream for my own consumption and not include it in my culture. But if the cream plays an important part and is needed, then I want to include it. In the end, it's a small portion, but if I'm going to separate and portion back what is needed, I'd rather not waste my cream if the lactobacillus is not really going to make any use of this. Thanks for clarifying this. Okay, this is a great question. And there's kind of a lot going on here. So first of all, when you're using raw milk for your cheese culture, I don't pasteurize it. I just use the raw milk straight up from the jug of milk. But when you achieve a flavor you really like in your mother cheese culture, if you want to make sure it absolutely preserves that flavor, there's a couple things you want to do. First, you do pasteurize the milk that you get that's raw, so that any other bacteria that are in there naturally are killed before you introduce the new bacteria, right? So that's how you maintain the flavor over time. And, you know, I know a lot of people think pasteurization is evil. It's not. It's just killing the bacteria. And if you have a mix of bacteria you really like, then go for it. Now, a lot of people will say it's dangerous and unhealthy to have different bacteria mixes that are already in the milk. I think that's a load of crap, because how do you think cheese came to be in the first place? Like, literally, you can take your raw milk, put it on the counter and wait, and you're going to end up with a cheese culture of some sort. The question is, will you like how that tastes? Second thing is, if you culture too high of a temperature, it can get a metallic or acidic flavor. And if you let it go too long on the counter, which won't kill it, it will become very acidic. And when it's very acidic, you may not like those flavors. And if that happens, you can totally recover from that by reculturing it and not leaving it out. So I do put it out for about 12 to 24 hours. I look at it in an environment that's around 72 degrees, and then I throw it in the fridge when it's done. And then before I use it, I do a single culture for 12 to 24 hours before I actually use it, if I haven't been using it on the regular. So that's all background on the mother culture and ways I've been using it. And I've been using them a lot this summer once I like had that brain epiphany. Now, the question at hand, though, is skim milk or whole milk, cream, no cream. And I can tell you that I accidentally stumbled on the best result possible, which is a little bit of fat in the milk, but not too much. And that's because every time I get my raw milk, I skim the cream, but there's always some left behind. So I end up with about 2% milk. Skim milk will maintain your culture more consistently for your mesophilic culture, but it's not the best option for feeding a thermophilic culture. Mesophilic means low temperature. Thermophilic means high temperature. So you'll use a thermophilic for yogurt or something. You'll use a mesophilic for chèvre or cream cheese. Okay? So different kinds of cheeses. I'm maintaining a mesophilic culture, so more towards skim or 2% milk is better with the lower fat so that it just eats those sugars and is good to go. So the answer is, Roy, yes, you can skim your cream out. Now, if you want to have a culture that can do both, and milk, it's magic, it can do both. You can have both a thermophilic and mesophilic culture in your milk, in which case you want to use whole milk as your vector for culturing it. And basically what will happen is the mesophilic culture will only come alive at lower temperatures. And if you use a thermophilic fermentation, the mesophilic won't wake up. Well, it'll die. So it won't be the dominant culture in your milk. So there's a lot going on here, but I just want you to know you can have your cream for your coffee and then use the rest of that milk to maintain your cultures, make milk kefir, do all sorts of things with the milk that can really, A, link you to delicious, homemade, from scratch food that you bring out of your kitchen. You can totally brag about that to your friends. And secondly, get that gut bacteria like up and alive and feed your system. It's really a cool thing. I love it. Speaking of cheese, if you want to come out to Tennessee, or if you're already in Tennessee, an hour east of Nashville, on August 23rd, we are doing what we're calling Curds and Connection. It is an event here at the Holler Homestead in our new lodge building with an awesome teaching kitchen where we're going to show you how to make three kinds of cheese, but actually that will accelerate into five or six kinds of cheese. And you'll get your hands on some of the cheese. You'll go home with some of the cheese. And then we're putting it together with a cheese pairing with cheeses throughout the world. That's what lunch is going to be. So it'll be, you know, cheese plus pepperoni or cheese plus pear compote. Or I'm not sure what all the things are going to be because you know who's consulting on this. That's right. Our very own chef, Kenny Daniels, is going to be on site helping me both teach the class and overseeing the pairing, which will be a delicious lunch as part of the class. Bring your own wine if you want to have some wine with your cheese. And then finally, we're ending the course with something no other cheese course does, and that's ways to use the whey beyond just spraying your tomatoes with it or making ricotta cheese. He has a special way to use whey to extract extra flavors that are delicious in mocktails and cocktails and for other uses in food. You're not going to want to miss this class, guys. Go to livingfreeintennessee.com and grab your tickets now. Space is limited. It's 9:30 in the morning till about 3 p.m. at the Holler Homestead, 1 hour east of Nashville. Hope to see you there. Make it a great week.
I just wanted to say one thing about pasteurized milk, and I think that we have gotten a little bit too over our skis. Not Nicole at all, but some of us with this whole raw milk desire. Obviously, I don't think there should be any prohibition whatsoever on raw milk. I think that it's a ridiculous thing, and it's completely unnecessary. And if they completely and totally, in every state, county, city, corner of the country, took away all prohibition against raw milk tomorrow, and it was easy to find in any grocery store, you wouldn't have any kind of rash of people dying or getting sick or anything. It's all bullshit. So, use that to temper what I'm about to say. Processing milk in of itself, you know, pasteurizing it is not necessarily bad if there's a reason you're doing what you're doing. And I think there is like this thing, well, I want my milk to be raw milk cheese, right? And then you find out that person is using a temperature to scald the milk that's high enough to pasteurize it anyway. Hello? You see what I'm saying? Now, not all cheese is made at that temperature, as Nicole inferred there. I'm just saying that, like, don't feel that pasteurized milk in of itself is a bad thing. Now, I think if you're going to drink milk, you should be drinking whole, raw, unpasteurized milk. That's just my opinion. You can do whatever you want, though. But the reality is there are certain enzymes in milk that are destroyed during the pasteurization process. And when you drink milk, many of these folks that have lactose intolerance and things like that, if they drink raw milk, they do not have the problems. Okay? And but you just said it was okay to pass. Yes, it's okay, depending on what you're doing with it and why you're doing it. Anyway, moving on. Let's go ahead and hear about open source software from Jesse Markowitz.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz with your personal BitcoinAssistant.com. Today I have a question from Kristen. Kristen asks, what is open source software and why might I want it? When people think of software today, they generally think of programs that are written by a company, sold by the company, and supported by that same company. Generally, that seems like a good thing because if you have any questions or need any help with it, the company that wrote the software knows everything about it and is happy to help you with it because you're a customer of theirs. You paid for it, and in some cases, you're paying a maintenance fee specifically to be supported. For most home users, you might commonly think of something like Microsoft Windows and Microsoft Office. There might be games that you play from Electronic Arts or Epic. In the business world, you might be familiar with companies like IBM, Oracle, and Adobe. Open source started in the early 80s with Richard Stallman creating a Unix-compatible operating system, followed by Linus Torvalds in the early 90s releasing the Linux kernel. Since then, there have been a huge number of open source packages released. Some of the current popular ones include Bitcoin, WordPress, Docker, Firefox, Brave, LibreOffice, and of course, Start9's StartOS. The key aspect of open source software is that the source code is open. It's freely available for anyone to use, to look at, to modify, and to redistribute. Unlike proprietary software, which keeps its code secret and protects it from being able to be changed or used, open source encourages users to look at the code, reuse it, and modify it for their own purposes. Think of it like a public cookbook where everyone can add their own versions of their recipes. There are a number of advantages for you, the end user of the software, for it to be open source. Even if you're not a programmer, and even if you're not able to personally look at the code, understand it, or modify it, just the fact that it's open source can help you in a number of ways. First, it's transparent and auditable because it's open. Since anyone can take a look at it and confirm that the software is doing what it says it's doing, so even if you personally can't inspect it, the fact that other people can means you're not stuck having to trust the original authors who wrote the software. If there's something wrong or an issue or anything, they have the potential to tell you about it. Think of it like reviews on a shopping website. Second, because many people can be looking at the software, particularly if it's a very popular platform, for example, Unix or Bitcoin, anything like that, the security vulnerabilities are generally found and fixed very quickly. This includes surveillance risks. A company that owns proprietary software might be secretly leaking information themselves to be used for advertising, marketing, sold to third parties, or given to governments for their usage. If it's proprietary and secret, there's no easy way for an outsider to check. Third, you're not locked into that one vendor's vision for the product. I used to be a very big user of a product called Evernote. The company was purchased, and the new owners shifted the focus from storing notes to being much more of a task management collaborative software. It's their software, their right to do what they want with it. But for me, being forced into upgrades every 2 to 3 weeks for features that made the product worse for me was very painful. Switching to an open source alternative gave me more control and the ability to run the software that I want, upgrade when I want, and get the add-ons and customizations from the programmers that I trust for that particular software. In the Bitcoin community, when folks were frustrated that the Bitcoin core developers were not doing as much as they thought should be done to fight against spam, they created their own version of Bitcoin called Bitcoin Knots that, while compatible, offered more spam-fighting features. Finally, and perhaps most importantly for many people, the cost to use open source software is free. Most open source projects do take donations, and I contribute regularly to a number of them, but there's no license fee that you're required to pay. If you'd like to try open source software at home, you can start by using Firefox or Brave browsers instead of Chrome or Edge. You can try LibreOffice instead of Microsoft Office. You can use Thunderbird for email, utilities like Notepad++ for notes, FileZilla for file transfers, and many, many more. On the server side, StartOS is designed specifically to make it easy to run open source server software that you host on your own home server. While most famous for Bitcoin and Lightning nodes, StartOS is also very popular for hosting your own file servers, password managers, communication software, AI, and a wide variety of other services. This has been Jesse Markowitz with yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com responding to your questions on Bitcoin and other technologies. Please do send more questions into Jack, and I look forward to answering them.
You know, I've actually thought about someday doing a show on open source software from a little bit of a different angle. Angle one, how open source software companies make money. I mean, they sell their software for free. You don't have to buy it. You can take it, you can modify it, you can use it. And there's some interesting business models that many companies have used. Basically give away the software for free, and they still make a shit ton of money. And in fact, in some ways, they're more successful than people that sell their software. But the angle B would be how you can use open source software to make money. Because anybody can further develop it, because you can integrate it with other projects, because you can build things like plugins for it, there's actually, for those that take the time to learn how to do it, quite a few opportunities to make money with open source software. I know people who are web design folks. Like, they have a little, you know, a little one-man web design company. You know what they use? WordPress. WordPress and all of the plugins, which are also open source, that work for WordPress. And some of them are premium, and maybe you buy those and you resell them to your customer or what have you. Or I've seen people do things like some of the plugins have a premium version for one site, some are multi-site, and some are unlimited sites. And, like, it's a three-tiered program, so maybe it's, like, $19 to buy the premium version of the plugin for one website, and maybe for up to 10 sites, it's, you know, let's say, give you a bit of a discount, so $140. But then maybe they have like an unlimited plan where you, once you own it, you have a software key that you can use and put it on as many sites as you want for $300. Well, if it's a premium plugin that web developer is going to use a lot with most or even all of their clients, they'll buy that unlimited license. And that gives them an advantage because they can sell more value, and everything, all the work is already done. You know, premium themes, there's theme packages, and so the person selling the plugin and selling the premium theme and things like that into the WordPress environment, they're making money. But the developer who's buying and basically repackaging it, he's making money. And then hopefully the site owner is now using this, you know, e-commerce-enabled website built on an open-source platform, using a plugin like, let's say, WooCommerce to sell product, and they're making money. And if you look at it from a perspective of what is a more successful model, open or closed-source proprietary software, in many ways, this open-source runs the world. I mean, desktops, which is what you use when you're on your computer, you know, mostly, you know, in the world runs on Windows and Mac, right? And those are both closed source. But the internet runs on Linux and Unix, open source. The most popular web development platform on the planet is open source WordPress. And there's a lot of other things like that. So I think it's an interesting thing to dive into from an economic standpoint and an opportunity standpoint, not just a, hey, I use open source because it's cool standpoint. So let's think maybe we'll put a pin in that and come back to it. Now, let's talk about dog training, one of my favorite things to talk about, with Joel Riles, and specifically, and he's doing a series right now on mistakes that dog trainers make, and this one is about going too fast, rushing things.
Hello, everyone. This is Joel from Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you again with another expert counsel segment. And today we're going to talk about common mistakes that people make when they're trying to train their dogs. And probably one of the biggest ones that I see in terms of people who are just communicating with me, they're working their own dog, maybe they've got Canine Academy, and they're trying to go through things, and then they reach out and they say, I have this problem, here it is. 9 times out of 10, that problem is because they're trying to push things too fast. So it could be, oh, I want my dog to run loose in the yard, and I've got chickens that free range. I'm going to let them go ahead and run and just see what happens, and they eat a chicken, right? Because they didn't do the training beforehand to try and make sure that eating chickens wasn't going to be a problem. And then they let the dog run around, and then it ate a chicken. Now, it's not that you can't fix that problem after the fact, but it's a lot easier to keep a dog from eating chickens and then teach them don't go near those chickens than it is once they get one and they're like, but that's food, and I'd really like to get in there and munch on that, but they could shock me now. So if we can keep the problem from becoming an issue before it happens, then that's our ideal situation. Another thing people will sometimes do is they'll take their dog somewhere like a park or something like that, not even a dog park, just like a state park, and they'll try and let them run off lead. And they haven't established that they have a really solid recall in a known environment that was safe, and now their dog's out in the woods and they won't come back to them. Right? These sorts of things happen when you jump too far ahead and you're just like, oh, I'm sure my dog will be fine. Let's just go ahead and do this. A lot of times they're not. It's not that you're going to fail 100% of the time when you're doing this kind of stuff, but whenever you're trying something new, whenever you're trying to push a little bit farther into something, it's always best to set up some kind of control measures so that should your dog not respond the way that you want, you have a way of keeping them safe, keeping them from running away, that sort of thing. Right? It could be something like using a long line attached to your dog so that even though they have a lot more freedom, they're still restrained to some degree. Right? It could be something like having an e-collar that they know how, what the responses to that should be, because I did it when I was at home. So even if they're far away from me, maybe I can use my e-collar. It could be just testing things in your home, like downstays, recalls, things like that. Before I start letting my dog off lead, maybe I take them into the yard, dragging their lead, and I make sure they're going to stay close. If I tell them to stay close, I make sure they're going to be obedient. Like if I want them to jump on something or lay down and wait, they're going to do that without me having to go and get the lead and correct them, so that then if I let them drag the lead in the park, well, they should be good because I've confirmed they were good at home. So the only difference is our location. So we just don't want to rush into things. I know sometimes we get our dogs, we start training, we get kind of excited about all the stuff they can do, and then we want to go and do everything right now. And you can push and do some things, that's good. We should always be taking the next step with our dog training, but don't rush ahead too fast in trusting your dog in a place where an animal, your dog, or yourself, or another person can get hurt if there's failure, right? The last thing we want to happen is we try to do something new with our dog and they end up running into a road and getting hit by a car, or we end up losing animals on the homestead, right? We want to so slow yourself down. Take your time, confirm your animals are good. Don't feel sorry for a dog that's in obedience. Dogs that are in obedience are going to be way more confident and way happier over the lifespan of their whole lives than dogs that are just let run around and do whatever they want. All right? So if you keep your dog in obedience, you confirm that they're good in as many of the associated situations as you can before you're going to go out and do something new, and then we make sure they're good there, and then we can go and try the pressure test after we put all our safety measures in place to make sure that everything's going to be okay. So you'll almost never regret taking those steps. If you're going to regret something with your dog, it's not taking those steps and then trying to jump ahead and do something we haven't confirmed, especially in a place where they can end up getting hurt. So we'll wrap that up there. Remember, if you have a dog that you want help training, check out canineacademy.us. Go over to Jack's website, thesurvivalpodcast.com. Click on that banner so that he gets credit for it. And check out the options we have. We did just add in a new mini course. If you have been training with a sport trainer in protection work, but you like the stuff that we talk about, the multiple attackers, the knife avoidance drills, all that sort of stuff, and you're like, well, how can I get my trainer to work with me to do some of those things without having to go find a whole new trainer? Check out, we call it Sport Field to Street Ready course. It's a little mini course. It's about an hour and a half long. It's got 8 different segments that talk about different things that you can do and ways to work with your sport trainer to develop some of these extra capabilities that aren't going to get you kicked out of training. So if you're interested in that, check it out. Also, we have our obedience packages there at Canine Academy. And if you're looking to get a working line puppy or a trained dog of any kind, Check out FortressK9.com, click on the consultation, send us a consult request, and we will reach back out to you. Until next time, remember, train hard and stay safe.
I love having Joel part of the expert panel because he's just probably one of the best there is in the business. I'll add a little bit on this, though. Some other things where people rush things. It's just, especially when you're working with a pup and you're teaching them basic commands and obedience, is trying to teach too much in one go. I'm pretty big on, if I can get that dog to sit, then we're going to work on sit until the dog always sits. And as soon as we get sit down, then we're going to add lay. And then when we're doing some training, we might do sit and lay. You see what I'm saying? And we're not going to try to teach sit and lay unless the dog is like, some dogs are super easy to teach. And like, it takes 5 minutes and that dog has sit as a pup. Right, and they're just good about it, and maybe you teach them two commands in a day, but if you teach them one command in a day or one command even in a week, you got five commands in just a little over a month, and five core commands, you know, are going to give you a fairly obedient young dog that you can then have a great foundation to train for anything. And I've also been thinking about doing a show on dogs again. I haven't done one in a long time, mainly because I have Joel to do all this stuff, you know, now. But I think that we have commands that we teach dogs that people think of as tricks, and they don't really understand that that command actually is incredibly valuable. Let me just give you two examples. Shake, right? The dog learns to shake, and other paw, right? Like, I always teach them to shake, and whatever paw they're usually, it will be their dominant paw, just like a person would reach out and shake with the right hand. The dog will reach out with, you know, the dominant paw, or a lot of dogs will mirror you. So if you ask with the right, that dog's going to give you the left. It all depends on the dog. But they'll have one that they will have be predisposed. And what I'll usually do, if I reach out with my right and they give me the left, the same to them, they don't have the etiquette we do of the crossing the streams type thing. So a lot of times, also when I say other paw, once they know, I'll just put my other hand out, and then that paw will come up. Oh, that's a trick, Jack. What good is that? I don't know. You teach the dog that touching its paws doesn't cause as many problems or mental distress. Because if you've ever worked with people's dogs who, you know, it's a mature dog and they never really got past this, a lot of dogs get really irritated, scared, nervous, et cetera, when you touch their paws. Well, how often do you have to touch your paws? A lot. It's like cutting their nails. What about the back paws? We'll get there in a second. We'll get there in a second. But just desensitizing touching the paws. In fact, in addition to teaching that skill, not trick, I also think it makes a lot of sense when you have a puppy do a lot of touching of their paws. Not playful either, like when they're calm and petting them and just pick their paws up front and back. Okay? But that would be an example of a trick. Now the dog has a spur, like a sand spur in its paw. And I've taught the dog to give me its paw. The dog give me its paw, I'll gently and gingerly as possible remove the sand spur. And like as I did this with Charlie when he was a pup, he got to the point where if he had a spur and he couldn't get it out with his teeth because it gets up in between their toes, and it's a difficult thing to use your mouth to get a pointy thing out of your foot, right? He would come up to me and give me his paw, and even if it hurt a little bit, he'd hold his temper while I did it because he knew I'd get it out for him. That's one example. Another example is lay. Lay has a lot of advantage. I just want the dog to lay down. When I take dogs to a vet, you know, now my vet now I've had for over a decade and he expects this, but many times I've had dogs at the vet like, well, if we can get them laid down, I'm like, lay, boom. You know, when they're on an exam table, for instance, one of the lifting tables, and then they want them to lay for the exam, lay. Well, what about getting them up? And I've been surprised at how many vets, and now it makes me realize how many people don't train their dogs well. Well, another command that we definitely think of as a trick, like lay is a core skill, sit is a core skill, but dead dog, right? That's clearly just a trick, Jack. No. Now you need to do something with the dog's belly or maybe their back paws, and if you desensitize touching the paws, it's pretty easy if a dog will just lay on its side to trim his back nails. There's a lot of things that we think of as tricks, but when the dog is good at it, you know, and leave it is a very important skill. But, I mean, the universal leave it sound, you don't have to say a word even. Just at, like, all my dogs, when they go to touch anything, if I just go, at, that's it, they will not touch it. It's an interesting thing. Anyway, let's go on and talk about my subject today, which is totally not related to dogs, a bit political. We're going to talk about gerrymandering. Now, this is big news right now because the Republicans are cheating in Texas. So all the Democrat reps ran away to Illinois, where they've gerrymandered the shit out of it. You have the governor of Massachusetts going, "We have no choice. Donald Trump and the Republicans are cheating. We need to gerrymander too now." Massachusetts is already gerrymandered. 44% of the vote in Massachusetts is Republican, but they don't have a single representative in Washington to represent 44% of their people. Are they going to do super duper gerrymander? Are they going to like cut their districts in half and try to double their seats? So you can't do that, right? And so this is all dumb. The redistricting process is something states have power over, and that alone makes it a states' rights issue. But I want to explain why today and ever since 1913, it's actually legitimately a states' rights issue, because a constitutionally mandated state power was removed. And when I say state in this, I don't mean S-T-A-T-E with the capital S. I mean lowercase s. States' rights as a state power. A power that would be in the control of Massachusetts or Illinois or California or Texas or Florida or Ohio or Kentucky. Okay? There was always a balance in the U.S. Republic that made it difficult for the government to do things, especially without the consent of the governed, not only meaning the total governed of the country, but individual states being able to say, we don't want to do this. And if you haven't made the connection yet to 1913 and what I'm talking about, obviously there's a bunch of things that happened in 1913, like the creation of the Federal Reserve, and some other things. But there was also the 17th Amendment to the Constitution. And this is one of the least known and most impactful amendments to the Constitution. It's one that they just gloss over if they even mention it in history class in high school. And I have no idea what they do today, but I know we talked about it for like 5.5 seconds when I was in high school. But I bet today they might not even talk about it at all. And this was considered a great big victory for democracy, and ignoring the fact that our founders hated democracy in the way that people mean it when they say it that way. Let me be clear. We are a republic, and we are a democracy. We're just not a direct democracy. But what we have as a republic in the form of a representative democracy is designed to preserve the rights of individuals first, states second, and the national government third. That's the hierarchy that was set up. And the only way you could do that, because government will always take away rights, is to put systems in place to put different factions and groups of government at odds with each other to make it less likely they would collude. And one of the means that we did that with was how senators got to be senators in this country. From 1912 back, this is how you became a senator, and when I say senator here, I'm not talking about state senator, federal senator. Right now you have two senators if you live in any state in the union. If you live in Florida, you have two senators. Texas, you have two senators. Here we have John Cornyn, a complete sleazebag, and Ted Cruz, a partial sleazebag. You know, they're probably better than the alternative Democrats like Beto O'Rourke, okay? But they're still not exactly the greatest people, and I'm going to come back to that. Don't think I said that just to prove that I'm not partisan here, because there's another piece to this puzzle. But anyway, the way you got to be a senator, like a Ted Cruz, like a John Cornyn, you know, like any of these senators, whoever your senator is, your state legislature appointed your senators, and it was done exactly the same way it is now, with staggered every 2 years, so it was a rotation in and out, right? And your state legislature appointed that senator to a 6-year term. Along with that appointment, and this was never used because it never had to be, because the fact it's a lot like having a willingness to spank your kids, which I don't, but if you do, some people have a willingness to do it and they only ever do it once or they never do it. The fact that it's there has an impact, right? The fact that you can do a thing, it has an impact on the person you can do it to, even if you choose not to do it. And that was the process of recall. So I'm not talking about a recall like we have today in some states. Like California has a recall procedure for the governor. You get enough signatures, you can literally force an election before an election is due to recall. But then you need to win the election. it would have been a simple vote by the legislature to say, we're recalling the senator from D.C. and we're replacing him. That gave the state legislatures a lot of power. You also have to understand, what was the purpose of the Senate in balancing power? And it was based on the House of Lords, and the House was based on the House of Commons in the UK. That's what we were modeling our government on, with modifications into a republic from a monarchy. Okay? Got that? Hope so. So, the entire point of the Senate was to make sure that states, every state in the senatorial body, had an equal say from the state. Right? The state, not the people. The people elected their state legislature, and then their state represented them. It is another layer in this juxtaposition, this antagonistic arrangement of government to slow the progress of government down. Okay? And in this way, a state, you know, today like Texas with over 30 million people, a little state like Wyoming or Montana or Nebraska has an equal standing in the Senate. Got it? But that equal standing was then backed up by your state legislators needing to get reelected. Your state legislatures, by the way, if you want to meet your state rep, it might take a little while, but you probably can sit down face-to-face with your state representative and probably your state senator, but definitely your state representative. You can get to them. They can hear you. And that's why it was actually considered that the senator more represented the state than if they were democratically elected. Well, all that was changed in 1913. The House, on the other hand, was designed to be the people's house, the House of Commons in the UK, right? This was the person that, in the time frame we're talking about, you probably knew. You probably knew them, or at least knew of them. Many people today have no idea who even their congressman is. And again, I know that technically senators and House reps are both congressmen, but they're representative. They don't even know who they are. At the time of the founding of the Republic, they did. And this was like pure popular will on the House side, more liberal, and then very conservative on the senatorial side. The will of the state the senator represented on equal footing between small and large states. And then larger states having more people had the on the other side of the House that was supposed to control the purse strings. All spending is to originate in the House, was directly answerable to the individual people by congressional district. That's how it worked. In 1913, the people of this country were sold a bullshit lie that your voice would be better heard if you voted for your senator instead of your state legislature. When that was taken away, the state itself lost a great deal of power, because how does a senator get elected today? It's a spending and popularity contest. You have to have someone capable of running a statewide race and winning both the primary and the general election in their state. This requires a lot of ass-kissing, sucking up, and selling out, because at a national level, a senator is important. A congressperson, a representative, is not that important individually to a corporation like, let's say, Pfizer or Exxon. So these big companies will spend money getting congressional reps elected, but they'll spend lots of money, giant super PACs, to get senators elected. So not only does the state no longer have a recall process, not only is the senator not currently appointed, but the senator is much more subjected to the concept of being pushed by lobbyists and campaign contributions to stay in line with the people to get them elected in the first place. The state legislature can no longer say, you know, we've had enough of John Cornyn. We've had enough of you. You're an effing rhino. We don't. Well, this is a Republican state. You're not being a Republican. We're swapping you out, even if they don't recall them. These senators going to office now, they're doing 3, 4, 5 terms. That's 30 years. And because it's a statewide popular election, it is very difficult to unseat an incumbent. About the only way we unseat incumbents in the Senate is when they lose the general and the state is a swing state, like, let's say, Pennsylvania. That's about the only way that happens. You understand the problem. So this is the other side of it. not only would the state have more authority representing the state, which is what the Senate was supposed to do, if we had not had the 17th Amendment. The state would have more flexibility in swapping out the senator while maintaining the party affiliation. Texas should have Republican senators. Why? Because no Democrat has won a statewide election in the state of Texas since 1994. Ann Richards, who eventually got her ass kicked out by George W. Bush as governor of Texas. That's how long it has been. So clearly this is a Republican. Whether you like it or not, it doesn't matter. This is a Republican state, period. So we should have a Republican senator, but should it be Cruz? Should it be Cornyn? Do these people need to be in office for 30 years? But again, because of how we elect them, this is very difficult. What does this have to do with gerrymandering in the House? I'm going to get there. Okay? So, gerrymandering, first, to define what it is, it's when you look at the congressional map specifically. This could be done in other places, but the big impact on federal elections is the representation map for your representatives. So, the House, like, everybody gets two senators. Nebraska, Wyoming, Montana, two senators. Florida, Texas, California, big states, New York, two senators. You see, everybody's the same foot. The House, it is a population-based thing, where Texas, I think, has 29, is what it, I think I remember, 29 representatives. California has like 40-something. I think next is like New York or Florida, right? They have lots of them. But that is to be apportioned by the state as to the population. So when you look at a congressional district map, and you see all these little different divided up things and all these weird lines on them, the more weird and twisted and elongated and non-square like shaped those districts are, the more gerrymandered that state probably is. And the reason you do this is you could have, let's say, a stronghold for the Democrats in a highly Republican state in an urban center. Well, if you split it right down the middle and cut it in half and attach it to a larger majority Republican area and make that a district, then you could take a city like Dallas and make it not even have a blue, a single blue dot on it. Even though Dallas, if you just took Dallas as a city and maybe made it, like, cut Dallas down in size to where it was one congressional district, it would be blue as the sky. Right? Or if you did it in Fort Worth the same way, it would be red as a fire, right? I mean, it just, those two cities, even though they're not that far apart, that's really the case. One is very conservative, one is very liberal. Or Austin is very liberal. But if you split it three ways and break it off into, like, East Texas, the Hill Country, and the River Valley, then you can basically write out the Democrats, and Democrats do the same thing. There's a district in Texas right now that during the last redistricting was gerrymandered for Democrats, kind of to get them to go along with it, that has people represented by the same congressmen that live in San Antonio and Austin, with a long barbell, like, you know, bar connecting the two. And it's just ridiculous, but it was a pacification. Like, we'll give you this because we're taking that. So how does that make it a state's rights issue? When a state like Texas realizes we can swing the balance in the House to Republican, and we're a Republican state using gerrymandering, and you took away our ability to do it with the Senate, oh, but Jack, they're both Republicans. You said, stop, we'll come back to it. They realize this is another way the state legislature, because the state legislature is the one who draws these maps. Which is constitutional whether you like it or not, because states run their own elections. That's part of us being a republic and having a Republican form of government. Not Republican Party, Republican form of government is to have the states manage their own elections and decide how they handle their elections in their states, as long as it complies with federal election law. Got it? Okay. But you just said, Jack, that since Texas is a Republican state, they should have Republican senators, and they do, and since that's the case, everything should be fine, and how do they not have control anymore? Because they do not have the ability to change the senator. Because this is what I'm going to tell you. If we still did things the way we did in 1912 back, the odds that we would have Ted Cruz are low. The odds that John Cornyn would be our senator are massively, massively, massively low. We would have we wouldn't just have more Republican senators right now under the old system. We would have different senators. Many of the rhinos you can't get rid of. Do you think John Thune would be pulling the bullshit he's doing right now if he was directly accountable to his state's legislature by not allowing Trump his recess appointments like every other president's ever had? No. There would be a phone call. John, you got a pretty cushy gig up there in D.C. You're the Senate Majority Leader. You want to stay there? Because we're kind of pissed right now. We're kind of pissed. This isn't what we wanted. Do you see what I'm saying? They had that leverage point that they no longer have. So what is their leverage point? You took away the leverage point in the Senate. The states, whether they knowingly did it for this reason or not, because everybody wants to win, ended up shoved over into the world of let's fuck with the House to assert more of what our state wants to assert in Washington, because what Washington does affects Florida and Texas and Maryland and Massachusetts and Illinois. And yes, even though I'm more familiar with what's going on in Texas because I live here, this applies to all states, including the side that you're not on, if you're on a side. So, but what if Illinois does it? Well, they already do, and it applies to Illinois, too. That's how I would respond to that. Of course they can do it. Of course it's legal, and it's still a states' rights issue. Just because I oppose what Illinois wants doesn't change the reality on the ground here. So gerrymandering is actually a states' rights issue. And it was made such. Like, if you did have control of the Senate the way that we did prior to 1912, I wouldn't take this stance. Because the state would have, therefore, that equal footing the Senate was designed to provide. So you should really ask yourself this question. Why did so many things go so wrong in 1 year? You want to know more about that? Check out C.J. Kilmer's Dangerous History podcast and look up one simple name. And that name, of course, is the absolute worst president to ever serve in the United States as president, Woodrow effing Wilson. Woodrow Wilson is the biggest scumbag, and yes, I'm including Biden, and yes, I'm including Trump, and yes, I'm including Bush, and yes, I'm including fill in the blank. Obama, whoever you want, Richard Nixon, whatever you want to come up with. I don't care, FDR, I don't care who. Biggest scumbag to ever serve as president of the United States, the person who has caused most of the misery of modern times, at least the genesis of it, because, as I said, others made it worse. I just did a segment last week on Johnson, and Johnson being more responsible for the death of the gold reserve currency than Nixon. Nixon closed the window, but all he did was call time of death. Right, so I'm not saying others didn't do it, but this man was the genesis of all this misery that began in 1913. While it wasn't an amendment in 1913, we created the Federal Reserve. We also instituted through the 16th Amendment the income tax, which we didn't even have until then. And the 17th changed how we elected senators. And one man was the captain of the ship while the ship took that course. I was going to say responsible for it all, but he wasn't responsible any more than the captain is for the ship. There's people that actually tell the captain where the ship needs to go at command. And that is how presidencies work in this country, whether you believe it or not. Anyway, we would have a completely different situation today. We would have different senators, and instead of 53 Republican senators, there would be 56. And throughout the majority of time over the last 50 years, we would have had a Republican controlled Senate. And I'm going all the way back to the 50s with that. Look it up if you doubt me. Anyway, and I said majority, not always. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and wrap things up for the day. Again, I want to remind you can always help the show. by doing your shopping starting at tspaz.com. If you become an MSB member, you'll get great discounts to a lot of different stuff. You know, I just had the folks on from North Spore yesterday. I don't even think we said it in the episode, though. I have a discount for you, 10% off everything at North Spore. That was just added to the MSB. The announcement went on the blog yesterday, went out in the Daily Mail, all the social media and all that. It's just, we just keep adding discounts. We've added a ton this year alone. You can get your money back plus. It's $50 a year. It's totally worth it. And then last but not least, if you haven't picked up a copy of my book, Laws of Life, please do so. And with that, I'll say have a great weekend.
You should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Revolution.